Welcome back to another episode of Palisade Radio. I'm your host, Karema Mutlu. And on today's show, we welcome back Matt Geiger, who's a managing partner at MJG Capital. How are you today, Matt?
I'm doing well, Karam. Thanks for having me back on the program.
I like to start the show by talking about your experience of when you go on a site visit. So let's talk about what you're actually looking for, Matt. I asked Lobo Tigray this question in an earlier interview, and he suggested that you'll generally be able to get a feel for something, either good or bad, by being on the project, hanging out with management, perhaps speaking to locals, rather than simply having a conference call with management. Would you agree with this? And I've noticed that you've been on quite a few site visits in 2019. So can you talk to us about that?
Absolutely. So I have been busy, and I do go on site visits quite often. I went back and did some counting ahead of this interview, and I think I've done just over 30 since the fund's inception, and I think up to 7 or 8 this year. And if anybody's interested, pictures from all of these visits are up on the fund's website. I agree with Lobo. I mean, I'd say there are quite a few benefits of going on these site visits. The first is that you can ask questions of management and gain tidbits of information that maybe you wouldn't over a 40-minute conference call. Ultimately, these site visits often last a couple of days, and you're spending time traveling with management, either in planes or in buses. You're grabbing meals with them, and and then of course checking out the site. So there's plenty of opportunity to ask questions that would maybe be tough or sensitive over a call. And then you can also just gain tidbits of information that you wouldn't have otherwise. So that's very much worthwhile. Secondly, I'd say you get a better sense of the company's culture, their organizational skills, and just the character and personality of management when you're on these sites, site visits, for similar reason, just that you get to spend in-person time with people and see how they treat the employees, see the organizational competency and all of that. I'd say third, once you get on ground, at the actual project, you get a much better sense for the infrastructure situation. How roads are going into site, is there power availability? You get a feel of the topography, is this hilly or easily accessible? Is there risks of flooding in the valleys? How easy is it going to be to operate here? You get a sense of site accessibility, as I mentioned, and also kind of the lay of the land outside of the project, whether there's a village nearby, whether there's locals that could potentially push back against development, or whether it's all clear on that front. And then, of course, you do get a sense of whether there's local support or opposition to the project. And then I'd say there are a couple more benefits of going on these visits that are unrelated to the actual company. The first is that you can often glean unique insights into other mining outfits that are operating either in the same region or in the same country. So oftentimes, you can get very good information about peers in the general area from the management team that you're visiting and get a sense of investments, other investments that you maybe would be looking at. So that's very worthwhile. And then the final added bonus is the site visit participants that you actually meet. And I can say for sure that some of my most cherished and valued connections in the mining space, I first met on site visits and then continued the relationship from there. So that's kind of another added benefit unrelated to the actual company you're visiting. Now, I will caution your listeners quickly here that there's one big danger of going on site visits, and that's becoming too friendly with management. These visits are often a lot of fun, not always, but often. And it's contingent on you as an investor to separate, and your personal feelings from your ultimate investment decision. And I, in fact, know some very smart investors that for this very reason avoid going on site visits. Personally, I think this is a bit too extreme. From my experience, the benefits of going on site visits do outweigh this risk. But it's definitely something to keep in mind. You need to be able to make a dispassionate investment decision, irregardless of your interactions with the management team.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting, actually. As you say, sometimes it is worth going on these site visits. Okay, let's talk a little bit about gold mining stocks in particular. We've seen some recent M&A activity for the gold miners in the junior space over the last few months, and it appears as though the deals are now starting to even get more attention within the mainstream financial press. So will this drive a new wave of investors to position themselves into the next potential takeout?
Well, I think so. I mean, I've definitely been blown away by the volume of high profile deals that we've seen just over the past few weeks, Karem. We're talking now in mid-December, December 18th, and I can count at least nine major transactions that have occurred over the past 6 weeks, so just since November 1st. And I made a quick list here. We, of course, have Kirkland Lake's $4 billion acquisition of Detour. We have the purchase of Newmont's Red Lake complex for between 400 to 500 billion, million by Evolution Mining. We have Saracen paying over $1 billion for Barrick's 50% stake in the Kalgoorlie super pit. Just this week, we then had Northern Star buying the other half of the Kalgoorlie super pit, this time from Newmont. We have Zijin's purchase of Continental Gold for $1.4 billion. That was a big payday for Eric Sprott. And then we also had Zijin's purchase, this was in November, of Freeport-McMoRan's Serbian assets for $400 million U.S. We also had Endeavor Mining's hostile bid for Centamin. Recently, it sounds like management teams are trying to hash out a deal, so maybe a little less hostile at this point. We had Taronga's purchase of Barrick's 90% stake in Massawa for $400 million. That was announced a couple weeks ago. And then, of course, just this week, the Leagold and Equinox merger, with Ross Beaty's Equinox joining forces with Justra's Leagold. And so there's been a ton of action as we close out the year. I would say that I think responsible M&A that involves high quality assets is good for the mining industry at large. The first reason for this is that it spreads corporate G&A out over more assets, which improves margins industry wide and is generally rewarded by the market and could be a potential catalyst for generalists to start trickling into the space. Additionally, when you see responsible G&A, you can see assets that were lost or maybe overlooked within a major mining company put into the hands of a mid-tier who's eager to fund brownfields exploration, and so to actually discover more ounces and build the deposit. Examples of this include, you know, Evolution at the Red Lake complex or Taronga at Massawa, because both Red Lake and Massawa have seen underinvestment, we could say, over the past 5 to 10 years. And then, of course, to your point, Karem, M&A gets the speculative juices flowing for investors. So I do see the higher quality development projects that are still in the hands of junior companies to see increased investor interest. And I think we're also at the point of the cycle where we're going to start to see some speculative interest trickle down to the better managed explorcos and prospect generators. So I'd say what we are seeing is very positive for the industry at large. And I think it's probably going to continue into the new year.
Excellent. Well, let's talk a little bit more specifically about jurisdictions that you like to focus on. And one that isn't mentioned too much within the mining community is within the Balkan region, which is in Southeast Europe. So give us an overview as to why you feel that this kind of jurisdiction looks appealing to you. And if a less well-known jurisdiction is now beginning to be developed into something substantial, I imagine that this gives you a first mover advantage when assessing the area and other areas around it.
Yes, indeed. As you note, I am particularly intrigued by the Balkan region from a mineral investment perspective. This includes countries like Serbia, Bosnia, and Bulgaria are the ones that immediately come to mind. In fact, at the moment, 15 to 20% of the fund's weighted portfolio is actually exposed to this region, which I think has a bright mining future for a few reasons that I'll run through here. So first, it comes down to a fantastic mineral endowment due to the West Tethyan Belt, which stretches through the Balkan region. The West Tethyan has already proven itself capable of hosting world-class mineral deposits. The Timok discovery in Serbia back in 2013, and more recently, Adriatic Metals Rupice discovery in Bosnia are the two most recent examples. Plenty of prospectivity in this area for large copper gold porphyries, as well as lead, zinc, silver, and barite VMS projects. So fantastic mineral endowment. Second point is that the region is full of past producing Soviet era mines, many of which saw their production halted, not due to depletion or due to declining grades, but instead due to conflict that broke out in the early 1990s surrounding the fall of the Soviet Union. So these mines were halted for reasons other than economics in a lot of cases. I'd say that these legacy mines are prime targets for modern exploration techniques that certainly didn't exist 30 years ago when the Soviets were exploring these projects. Additionally, in many cases, the Soviets left behind significant amounts of precious metals, so both gold and silver, which, in many cases weren't even assayed for. And the reason for this is that the Soviets, they didn't particularly value precious metals. Instead, their industrial state was hungry for metals like zinc, lead, copper, and barite. So there's precious metals to be recovered. They would go ahead and do it, but they wouldn't go out of their way to define more precious metal resources, which is pretty funny in today's day and age, given the premium that we place on gold and silver just 30 years later. So the MJG Fund has been a long-term holder of Adriatic Metals, which is the perfect example of a company that has applied modern exploration techniques near a past Soviet producing mine. And it, as I mentioned, it has resulted in the world-class Rupice discovery just a few kilometers from the existing pit. So I feel these legacy Soviet operations are great pathfinders for discoveries in the immediate vicinity. A third reason I like the region comes down to demographics. And it's that we're seeing a mass migration of Balkan youth moving out of the countryside and either into the capital city, whether that's Belgrade or Sofia, or to Western Europe entirely, so completely out of the region. And this is significant because a 2016 study showed what many of us know intuitively to be true, and that is that younger generations are more opposed or more resistant to mining activity than older generations. And as such, this migration of Balkan youth out of the countryside, out of the more remote regions of the country where the mines are ultimately found, into the cities where the mines, of course, aren't found, has the potential to decrease the risk of local opposition to mining projects. So this is a longer term trend, but I think it's a positive in terms of social license and permittability. And then the final point I'll raise here is that the Balkan countries badly need economic development in the years ahead. And this is due to inverting population pyramids, where we're seeing very large amounts of older retirees in the country and fewer younger workers who are paying revenue to the state. And of course, the rising pension obligations that come from this inverting population pyramid. So ultimately, I think there's a chance of us seeing permitting timelines, concession fees, mining regulations, corporate taxes, royalties, all becoming more favorable for mining investors and mining companies in the years ahead out of necessity as these countries do what they can to drive further economic development. So this, again, is a longer term trend, but I think it's wind at the sails of mining outfits operating in the region. Now, I will say quickly, there are a few downsides, of course, to operating in the Balkans. Corruption is a very real problem, and this slows permit timelines and can sometimes even result in ownership disputes. So that's a clear negative. Additionally, the concession fees can be high in certain countries. Bosnia comes immediately to mind. And also, many of the countries have relatively new mining codes, which have, in some cases, been largely untested. And there's still a lot of skepticism amongst foreign and international investors. But I will say, even with these negatives in mind, I think there is a tremendous opportunity to invest in the handful of management teams that have been active in this region for years, already have deep connections in country, both politically and technically, and already have staked and acquired some of the very best ground. So I do think there are opportunities for teams that have been active for years in the region. And to answer your final question, just looping back, I do believe it is your responsibility as an investor to follow the developments in any country that you invest in. And as an investor, you always reserve the right to change your mind and exit a jurisdiction if circumstances change. You know, changing circumstances could be an unfavorable election. It could be war breaking out in a neighboring country. It could be unexpected changes to the mining code. You know, there are a whole host of reasons for why it would make sense to change your mind about a particular jurisdiction and exit town. And as such, you know, I do reserve the right to change my mind on the Balkans if circumstances change. But for now, I think things are looking up for the region.
Well, let's talk a little bit about changing your mind when specifically talking about your fund. I'd be interested to know, do you actually average down on a specific stock if the price continues to decline once you've bought it, or do you have stop losses in place? And what would be the biggest red flag you look for after you buy a stock? As I imagine you keeping on top of the story and watching the progress of management to see if they're going to execute on their strategy is also part of your investment thesis going forward. Would that be correct?
So it's a good question. I think for some context before I jump in, I invest from a value framework. So for each and every one of our investments, I have an intrinsic value per share, and this differs from the actual share price, an intrinsic value per share that I arrive at, you know, either through risk-adjusted discounted cash flows, maybe through a sum of the parts approach, or maybe through an expected value calculation. But I look at the intrinsic value per share, basically what I think the company should be worth per share, and then compare this to the company's current share price. Oftentimes, these two figures will be very close, but occasionally there'll be a large disparity, and it's worth digging deeper and finding out if there's a reason why. There's not a clear reason why, then it could be a mispricing. And when I look at investments, I try to find ones where the intrinsic value per share is at least 100% higher than the current share price. So I want to see a pretty sizable delta in order to get excited. Stop losses, in my opinion, are anti-ethical to this value approach. You know, assuming that there is no change to the intrinsic value per share, a given stock, a hypothetical stock that drops by 50%, is mathematically 100% more attractive than it was before that 50% drop. So why would you force yourself to sell as the stock becomes more and more attractive to own? So I think it just pushes directly against the value approach. So we do not use stop losses. You know, and this is where averaging down does come into play, which is certainly something we do. Ideally, you don't have to. Ideally, you catch the stock, you know, if there's a declining share price, you catch it towards the bottom. Maybe there's 5 to 10% downside and then things turn. But that's not always the case. And, you know, things can go farther in both directions than you expect them to do. And so when necessary, we do average down. In fact, I would never buy a company or I never make a new investment if I didn't feel comfortable averaging down were the share price to decline further and were the company's underlying fundamentals not to change. So that's a key caveat there. Sometimes share price declines are caused by fundamental changes to the business. And that kind of comes to the final point. There are, of course, situations where I would decide to liquidate a given position rather than averaging down, rather than doubling down. And this is what happens if we see a decline in share price caused by fundamental change to your original investment thesis. So this is, in my mind, the biggest red flag to look for, a change in your original investment thesis. Examples could be, you know, the management team switching focus from one particular jurisdiction or one particular project to a new jurisdiction or a new flagship project, and you were not expecting that change as an investor. It could be there was a step out drill program that you thought was very promising, things just didn't work in your favor. The program largely missed. There weren't the results that you expected. And again, your thesis has changed. It could be a situation where there was a permit you expected to be granted, but it's been unexpectedly denied. And now there's a 2-year longer wait for the outcome that you're anticipating. So all of these are examples of where you'd want to not average down and instead just hit the bid, take your money off the table and move your capital elsewhere.
Yeah, some really good points there. Okay, as we begin to wrap up, Matt, perhaps talk to us a little bit about EVs and the nickel market today. In our last interview, we talked about the potential for nickel, and as we talk today, the spot price has been correcting. Is this backing and filling price action for nickel good for the market in the long run, perhaps before EVs really begin to go mainstream over the next few years? And is there anything else on your mind at the moment?
Sure. So there has indeed, I think there's been a 20% pullback in the nickel price since we caught up a few months back in Q3. I think a lot of speculators have been disappointed by this pullback. To me, it's unconcerning. And I think for most investing with a 3 to 5 year time horizon, it's unconcerning. Even considering the pullback, nickel has had a phenomenal year. Particularly in light of how the rest of the battery and base metal complex performed. I think the nickel price has increased 30% year to date. So it's looking like for 2019, there'll be at least a 30% gain in the nickel spot price, where most of its peers in industrial and base metals had ugly years, to say the least. I'm still very much bullish on the nickel thesis. At the end of the day, I am a bottom-up investor, so my focus will always be on the management team. It will always be on the asset quality. It will always be on the financial structure and upcoming catalysts. But in terms of investment narratives that I think have the opportunity to gain traction in the years ahead, mainstream financial interest, I think the nickel narrative is right up there at the top of the heap. Nickel inventories continue to be at record lows, even in light of this price pullback. The nickel exploration and development expenditures that we've seen over the past 15 years have been negligible. It maybe picked up a bit in the past couple years, but compared to most base and energy metal industries, we've seen very little spent on new discoveries or advancing existing discoveries through the project pipeline towards production. So the cupboard remains bare. And then, of course, there's the twin forces of increasing electric vehicle adoption, coupled with the fact that electric vehicle batteries are becoming more and more nickel rich. I think that this narrative is going to continue to gain steam in the coming years. To your point, I would say that if anything, the weakness in the nickel price is good for long-term nickel adoption, if you want to put on your rose-tinted glasses. That's definitely what the global nickel producers believe. They don't want to see the nickel price go parabolic, like we saw the cobalt price go parabolic in 2017. When a metal price goes parabolic, the end users start thrifting. So they start, if anything, using less and less of that metal in their end products and not more, like we're seeing with nickel. And additionally, you start to see investments into entirely new technologies. So maybe battery technologies that don't include nickel at all. So you know, while us speculators are more impatient, and I don't know if we necessarily mind a parabolic nickel price starting tomorrow, I can say for sure that the major nickel producers that are looking to sell into this market for decades, and the battery makers as well, are aligned in that they don't want to see nickel price, you know, triple in over the course of the year, like we saw with cobalt. So in some ways, yes, this lower nickel price does ensure that the trend of increasingly nickel rich battery cathodes will continue for the foreseeable future. And it's less of an incentive now for companies to invest in new technologies or to spend any effort trying to thrift nickel out of batteries. So from a longer term perspective, you're correct.
Fantastic. Okay, well, many thanks for your time today, Matt. And how can people reach out to you if they want to find out more about what you do?
Thanks, Karim. It's great being back on the program. As always, listeners can go to the fund's website at mjgcapital.com. A lot of good information there, including recent press, site visit picks, as I mentioned earlier, and then all of the fund's investor letters are posted there since inception. So a lot of material. There's also a contact page if any of your listeners want to reach out, discuss the fund, the resource and industry in general, or any of our specific investments. I always love interacting with the Palisade listeners. And I very much look forward to our next discussion in 2020.
Think you understand the junior mining sector and you think that the participants in the mining sector, junior mining sector, are good people and kind people? Hit the bid.
How violent that term could be? It actually could be quite violent. It could be a rip your face off uranium rally.
And the world is always going to need raw materials. It's going to need copper and gold and nickel and so forth.
Totally destabilized. Hey, troll, did you hear what's going on in Yemen?